This is Equestrian Legacy Radio, and I'm your host, Gary Holt. On behalf of everyone at Equestrian Legacy Radio, we want to wish you and your family a very happy new year, and we wish you the best as we start this first day of 2015. Equestrian Legacy Radio has over 100 hours, 100 programs in our archives now, and this was a fun show that we did a couple of months ago, featuring Mary Kay, an outstanding young lady who's a great singer and songwriter. And also, this show features Roland Cheek, who is the co-founder of Backcountry Horsemen of America. And because this show has fallen on a holiday, we've not invited guests for a live show, but this is one that we think you'll certainly enjoy. And so we're going to share with you now this New Year's Day special with Mary Kay and Roland Cheek. And again, from Equestrian Legacy Radio, wish you and your family the best in 2015. This is Equestrian Legacy Radio's Campfire Cafe, and I'm your host, Gary Holt. Today, our guests are multi-award-winning artist Mary Kay, and in the second half of our show, author and co-founder of Backcountry Horsemen of America, Roland Cheek joins us. The Campfire Cafe is made possible by our great sponsors at the General Store. You'll find everything for the horse lover and folks that love the equestrian lifestyle in the General Store on our website at equestrianlegacy.net. When we come back, we'll be talking with Mary Kay. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, heard around the world online at equestrianlegacy.net.
Well, the hearts are turning, made this man as wise as he was old. And words don't come easy, but his eyes are the window to his soul. His life was like a wheel rolling over and over again, till that woman drove in.
They rolled into bed.
Kay is a multi-award-winning singer and songwriter and is a 2014 nominee for Female Performer and Entertainer of the Year with the Western Music Association. I'm pleased to welcome back for the third time to the Campfire Cafe, Mary Kay. Mary, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Always a pleasure to talk with you. And when we talked briefly yesterday, I asked if there was anything in particular that you'd like to talk about, and the first thing you said were horses and family.
It's true, yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Well, it's just the beautiful, we live in such a gorgeous area of the country, and we're fortunate enough to live in a place where we don't need to trailer in our horses for beautiful trail rides. And you know, whenever I think about you and your shows, I was thinking about our family and what an impact it's made in our family's lives to have horses, to raise kids with horses.
Well, it's a pretty cool life. And I've told people before, I've been blessed to never have known life without horses in them. And so it's been a joy to be able to combine that passion with this radio program and meet other people that share the same love for horses and family and music. And, you know, every time that I mention to someone that you have 10 children, their mouth just drops open.
Thank you.
Well, talk to us a little bit about your kids and your family. And, of course, you have a very close family. Brad, your husband, manages Mary Kay. And I know some of your kids are really involved in horses. But talk to us a little bit about how you got involved and about your family and their horse experiences.
Well, you know, I never planned on being a professional singer or songwriter or entertainer. My husband, Brad, and I, when we married, we decided that we really, really wanted a big family. We wanted to raise them on some land in a small town with horses. And so, you know, that was my life plan, and it still is. But when I was pregnant with our tenth child, a friend talked me into buying a guitar, and that was 8 years ago, almost 9 years ago, and I started playing music, and the songs that I was writing were all about our life in this little rural western town. And one thing led to another, and the songs started getting recorded. And, you know, it was interesting because back when I was expecting our 10th baby, we were fortunate enough, or crazy enough, depending on which way you want to look at it, to have all 10 kids home at the same time. So our oldest was about 17 years old, and our youngest, of course, was the infant. And our house was just full to the brim. All those kids are about 2 years apart in age. And as crazy as it is looking back on it, those are just precious years, because you forget that they're going to grow up and move away. So just in those 9 years since I bought that guitar, five of the kids are now grown, three of them are married, and two are adults and on their own. And we've got the five children at home. And Gary, I have to tell you, I am so glad we had so many kids, because I so enjoy being a mom, and I think I would just be heartbroken if I was done. And the good news is I'm a better mother. I just feel like I'm so much more relaxed, and I'm just enjoying the kids more, because I know they're going to move away. I know they're going to be gone someday, so I'm just treasuring them more.
Well, I was just thinking, if you had had a few more children, you could have had your own reality TV show.
Yeah, what was I thinking? You know, the sad truth is, I think that if I hadn't started writing music and singing, I think I would have maybe had more children. you know, people need to realize that for those of us who really enjoy parenting, it is kind of a career. You know, it's something that you're the CEO of this little army of, you know, a family. But the thing about being a mom is it feels forever, and it's just really, it is forever, but those kids do grow, and you have to be able to have things to do with your life beyond that. And so I'm real grateful to have found music, Western music.
Well, we're grateful that you did as well. And we want to talk some more about your kids. There's a song that we want to play, and we're going to try to get in quite a few of your songs today during the show in a limited amount of time. But there's a song, and we've done this before when you were on the show. This is one that's called Once Upon a Horse. Can you tell us a little bit about how that was written?
Well, you know, some people are just born with a gift of horses. And our oldest daughter, she just has that connection to horses that she was born with it. And so we grew up next to my father-in-law, who was a pretty well-known horse breeder. And so our little oldest daughter, Alicia, she just grew up always in the horse barn, always cleaning out stalls and working with the horses and visiting with the trainers. And so when she was about 8 years old, she told us that she wanted to have her own horse. And so we told her that she could do that, but she would need to earn her own money to buy her horse. And so she did. She cleaned stalls for her grandpa, and she bought her first horse when she was about 12. And that horse is still with her. She lives not too far away from you in Tennessee now. And her horse, our daughter Alicia, is 27. And her horse, Malise, is also 27.
Oh, wow.
And they're still together. They spent all their high school years doing endurance racing and rodeo cleaning and trail rides. And we just felt like her earning the money to achieve that dream was really important, and it was. And she just has shown, it's just really taught her responsibility. And all of our kids like horses, but some of them just have a better connection than the others. But this song is for her. I wrote it for her.
Well, let's listen to this. It's Once Upon a Horse, and it's from the CD No Wilder Place, and we're talking with Mary Kay.
Once upon a horse, a story started when a little girl could not be parted from her toy horse that Daddy bought for Fifth birthday. Forget the dresses and Barbie dolls, she'd spend her days in Grandpa's barn in her coveralls, knee deep in mud and covered in hay. She did find peace of mind in that dusty barn, 'cause she knew her dreams would come true if she really wanted to. So once upon a horse, that girl decided to save her money, find a horse and buy it. Didn't matter at all, she was only 10 years old. Secret to all good fairy tales is hard work when all else fails. You could have seen her smile for a mile when that horse was sold. She did find peace of mind in the smell of that mane, and she knew their new best friend. Mm-hmm. the girl grew older, riding farther away, becoming beautiful and bolder, winning buckles and crowns and ribbons for all to see. And just like in the story of Cinderella, she went to the ball and met a handsome fella, took her from her mountain home to his kingdom by sea. But she did find peace of mind in her new home, 'cause she knew her dreams would come true if her horse could come too. So once upon a horse, the story goes, in a kingdom by the sea where the honeysuckle grows, there's a little brick house on 5 acres of land. And out in back where the grass grows tall, there's a pasture and barn and a couple of stalls. And she's happy ever after, riding whenever she can. 'Cause she does find peace of mind on the back of that horse. And she knew her dreams would come true. Oh, yes, they do. Once upon a horse. Once upon a horse.
Beautiful song, Once Upon a Horse from the No Wilder Place CD. And I'm still going to hold you and Brad to it when you get down to visit. We're going to have to hit Miller's for
yes,
a meal. So that would be a lot of fun. You know, I was thinking, too, while I was listening to that song, your family, one day you and Brad will sit back as you have grandchildren, and the children are grown and out of the house, and you start having grandchildren, you have your family gatherings. You're going to sit back and say, Brad, look what we've done.
Yeah, I think we. I hope we will, and hopefully it'll be a good thing.
Gosh. Well, we're getting close to the holiday season, and my dad has been gone about 17 years now, a little over 17 years. And one of the Christmases, I told Mother as we were looking at my brothers and all of our children and now grandchildren, and I just made that statement. I said, look what you and Dad did. And that's part of the blessings of being parents, and that is to be able to have those grandchildren and sometime great-grandchildren. And what a great life you've given your kids to grow up the way that they have, sharing so many great memories and stories. Pretty exciting. Pretty exciting. You still have 5 children at home. You have a couple of your daughters that are actually doing some traveling and performing with you, don't you?
Yes. Yeah. I've done so much traveling just over the last few years with music that, you know, it's been working out great at home with having older children and plenty of drivers to get these kids where they need to go. But looking down the road in the future with the touring and such, we just really wanted to involve kids more in the Western music things. And we happen to have really amazing kids. And they're very talented, and so I thought, well, you know, I'm going to teach these girls how to play guitar and to sing with me. And it's been a really great experience to just sit down with them after dinner and teach them harmony, teach them chords. And not only that, but really explain what the songs are about and giving them a history lesson about the story of the West and what each of these songs is about, what it's referring to. And it's been fun to be able to share the music side of my life with my girls. The two daughters that sing with me right now are Millie and Sophia, and they are 16 years old and 14 years old. And then the two youngest daughters are Cece, her name's Cecilia, but we call her Cece, and Adeline. And they are also learning to play and sing together, but they're still so young that we're just, you know, we have them, we bring them on stage to sing some songs, but really it's those two girls. And, you know, one thing that's really surprised me is that Millie, the 14-year-old, she has a gift from God. Her voice is, her voice stops people in their tracks. And the first time we sang at a festival together, it was her very first time on stage. And we were sharing the stage with some big shots. Dave Stamey was there, and Waddy Mitchell were the other two people on the show. So at the end of my set, I brought up Millie and Sophia to sing. And Millie sang God Must Be a Cowboy. It's, you know the song. And now I'm forgetting who wrote it. But she got a standing ovation in the middle of the song. And I think that it was a moment that I realized that it's not just a little fun thing that we're doing, singing with the girls, but it will probably grow into something quite, I think God's hand is in it, and that we'll just see that it grow and grow, because she just really has an amazing voice. And I'm used to being the one that people say, oh, you sing so well. But when Millie sings with me, she gets every compliment there is. Sophia and I just stand in the back and nod yes.
Oh, gosh. But isn't that neat? I mean, that's just got to be so neat. It really has to be neat. You know, there's another song that we want to play right now. And the name of the song is God Is in the Roses. And is there a story behind this song, Mary?
Yeah. Let's listen to the song first, and I'll tell you the story.
Okay, all right. We're going to listen to God Is in the Roses. We're talking with Mary Kay, and you're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio.
Him I will rely.
God is in my thorn. God is in the stillness. And God is in the storm.
God is in the roses, and that's from the Real Thing CD. And Mary, what's the story behind that song?
Well, that's one of the very first songs that I wrote, and it was inspired by a kind of a hard experience we had our son Luke, we went on family vacation, and he was still kind of young, and he went off with the older kids to go swimming, and there was no lifeguard at the pool, and they found him at the bottom of the pool, and someone there resuscitated him, but it was really touch and go on the way to the hospital and the ambulance. And so at the hospital, I realized that he would be all right. But all through the night, I was crying and crying. And finally, the nurse asked me why I was crying. And it was one of the biggest lessons I learned in my life, and that is that I am not in charge and that it's okay, that God can be trusted, whether or not my child was taken or my child was spared. And I think when you get to a point in your life where you learn that lesson of trust, that it's okay to trust God, that there are good things and bad things, that God is in all of it to help us through and to not be afraid. And that lesson in my life has really blessed me with so much courage to do things and to not be afraid, but to just trust and be connected to God, and that His hand is in things and it's all right.
Well, it's a powerful song, and it is difficult to just turn things over to Him. But as you said, it's not in our hands, it's in His. Beautiful, beautiful song and a great meaning. And thank you for sharing that story with us. You know, you've got so many great songs. And when I was sitting down yesterday trying to decide what music of yours to share, it was really difficult. I mean, there's just so much great music that you have written and performed. There's another song that really is one of my favorite, and that's one that's called Arizona in Her Eyes. And yeah, tell us about that one. I think you've shared that once before, but tell us about this song.
This song was inspired by a friend of mine that lives in Arizona. And she's not particularly what the world would call beautiful, but her husband loves her so much, and she is just beautiful. And she's no longer in her 20s, you know. She's in her 50s. And I wanted to write a love song that really told the story of mature love. The kind of, whenever I listen to Arizona in Her Eyes, I think all men should listen to that song, because this is really what women would like from the men in their lives. We would like men to look at us and see our real beauty. That not has doesn't have to do with age, or it's just a kind of a really beautiful, mature love, and that's what this song is about.
Well, let's take a listen to Arizona in Her Eyes, and we're going to come back and talk with Mary Kay again. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio.
He sees Arizona in your eyes, all the promise of a desert at sunrise, soul of wonder, landscape of surprise. Yes, he sees Arizona in her eyes. Hers are the hands that have seen the sun. west, he never will change. And when the wind is lifting her long hair, with the scent of the sonoran in the air, God alone can hear this cowboy's prayer. Granted in that woman standing to his drought, this woman is his rain. Welcome storm to wash away his pain. Her thunder and her lightning unrestrained, and equal to this cowboy she has claimed. Hers are the hands. Chamber of a single shotgun, wild is her watchword, and beauty is her name. Heart of the West, he never will take. For he sees Arizona in her eyes, all the promise of the desert at sunrise, soul of wonder, landscape of surprise. Yes, he sees Arizona, he can hold but cannot own her. Yes, he sees Arizona in her eyes.
Well, I'm moved every time I listen to that song, and it's absolutely great. It's from the Dawn and the Dusk CD, and a lot of great music on there. Again, it was very difficult to try to decide what music of yours to share with people today, but I think that folks have been listening to the show, and they can see what a sweet spirit and what a great writer and talent that you are, and so we appreciate you sharing with us, and what a wonderful family that you and Brad have created. And want to invite the Kay sisters to join us on the show when they have some music that we can share. That would be a lot of fun.
We're working on it. We're working on it.
Well, we're looking forward to that. And we want to let folks know where they can find your music. And they can go to mary-kaye.com, and I believe they can order the music there, can't they, Mary?
They sure can. Downloads or CDs.
Okay. Absolutely great. I would encourage people to pick up any of the CDs. They're all great. The Dawn and the Dusk is the latest CD, and it's terrific. There is a Christmas EP that you did called A Cowboy Christmas. And
yes.
Gosh, it's just got such great music on there. We shared that last year, and hard to believe that the Christmas season is almost here again.
Mm-hmm.
But, wow, it's going to be here before long. And I guess your Christmas shopping is kind of hectic with that many in your family. Anyway.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it's a joyous occasion, a great time of the year. Tell us where you're going to be, because we want people to find Mary Kay out on the trail somewhere.
Well, next week I'm singing in Death Valley, California for their 49ers encampment. Belinda Gale will be there with me, and I'm excited to see her. She and I are very good friends. And then the following weekend, we've got the Cave Sisters with me, and Brad will be there as well. We're going to the Western Music Association awards show and convention. And so got a busy next 2 weeks. But, you know, you can always find me on Facebook. My husband and I are really involved in keeping everything up to date and interesting information. And so you can also find me on Facebook.
Well, I would encourage people to do that and also visit the website. And you're blogging some now, too.
Yeah, I blog I blog seasonally. That's what my husband says. So I do a blog a season. But it's fun because I kind of get to recap, you know, what's gone on in the summer, the fall. Yes, I blog occasionally.
Well, I will tell you, I enjoy your blog post when you do that. So I look forward to seeing those as well. So anyway, Mary Kay, a fantastic artist, a great young lady, and we again visit mary-kaye.com and purchase some of her great music. And I would certainly pick up A Cowboy Christmas for the holidays. You'll enjoy that music as well. And we're going to close this segment of the show out with one of the songs from that, and that's called A Cowboy Christmas Tonight. And Mary, I look forward to having you back for a fourth time on the show. You're always a joy to visit with.
Well, thank you, Gary. Thank you so much for what you do. We appreciate you.
Well, thank you, and happy holidays. Merry Christmas to you and your family, and we'll keep up with you on Facebook and look forward to talking with you again soon.
Sounds wonderful.
All right, thanks so much. This is A Cowboy Christmas Tonight from the A Cowboy Christmas CD.
Crunch of the snow and the bite of the air, the clang of the stockyard gate. Keep the truck running, the radio humming tonight. You don't want to be late. The smell of the wood smoke, the light from the windows, welcome you back home again. Kick the snow off your boots and shut the door tight. Let the celebration begin. With a cowboy Christmas tonight. Watching headlights bump down the old gravel drive as family and friends arrive. Get out the guitars and everyone sings Jingle Bells and Oh Holy Night. The men all swap stories of past cowboy glory, the weather and the high price of hay. All the food brought tonight was cooked up just right, and we all hold hands as we pray. It's a cowboy Christmas tonight. Kids are all whispering secrets down round the Christmas tree. The grown-ups gather up coats to call it a night. Dinah will be there soon, but there'll still be stock to see. Christmas on the range starts early and bright. Goodbye to your friends. Time to tuck the kids in. There's one last thing to be done. Get out the Bible, light a candle, read the story of God's own Son. Long, long ago on a range much like this, there were shepherds and a star shining bright. wise men brought gifts and the angels did sing, bringing honor to Jesus feels right with a cowboy Christmas tonight.
Roland Cheek has been an outfitter, columnist, and radio personality. He is one of the founders of Backcountry Horsemen of America and is an author. When we come back, we'll be talking with Roland Cheek.
Howdy, I'm Roland Cheek to tell you I believe in preserving part of America the way our forefathers found it. Preserving a modicum of land in its wild state seems to be a sensible way to do it, but I've come to realize there's more to conservation than retaining wildlands. We can save wild and beautiful places like the Great Smokies, Boundary Waters, and Grand Canyon, and still find hollow victory if the neighborhood has gone to pot while we circled wilderness wagons. No matter how many Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks are preserved, the goal should not be to spend our lives dwelling in inhospitable rabbit warrens in our everyday life. It may be theoretically possible to set aside every bit of forest land as wilderness and wind up without a chance to view a wedge of mallards winging north come spring. While scenic backdrops can indeed be saved by preserving the wild country about them, other Americans are more concerned their topsoil doesn't wind up in Nebraska. Conservation in reality means returning water to streams in drinkable condition, air clear enough to view distant mountain ranges, wildlife in historic complement, not just the kinds tolerant of man or that man will tolerate. All of us, well, most of us, are concerned about holding on to our own special culture, the self-sufficient, bow-down-to-no-king, independent American. We're American individualists with a capital I, and it sets us apart from yuppie, hippie, dopey, and whoopie in a pox on the literary establishment that says we do not exist. We'll take cowboys as a for instance when we come back next. Some hold that cowboys were really never more than Hereford pushers. Everybody who's anybody knows that's simply not true. They know the term cowboy denotes an abundance of chivalry, honor, loyalty, and candor. And we know the breed shuns deceit, dishonesty, hypocrisy, and treachery. Where cowboys roam, everyone expects other folks, whether cowboy, butcher, baker, or candlestick maker, to look them in the eye and tell the truth or tell nothing. We have our differences of opinions, yes, but they're honest differences discussed in open forum by all of us cowboys and cowgirls. We disagree and sometimes are disagreeable, but we're always predictable and usually motivated by instincts that would be thought noble in lesser, looser lands. Tomorrow I'll be back to skip rocks. Until then, this is Roland Cheek saying so long on Trails to Outdoor Adventure.
Roland, welcome to the Campfire Cafe.
Well, thank you, Gary.
Well, you have...
You've got to be some kind of distaff chivalry to have me following such a beautiful... talented lady as Mary Kay, and not only that, I'm old and ugly.
Well, you have to go back to that Arizona in her eyes that we played a little bit earlier. I don't know if you heard the conversation about that, but beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But you have quite the resume. You've worn more hats than most have in two lifetimes. And we've got a lot to talk about, and want to start out, Roland, talking about where you grew up and how the love of the outdoors came about for you.
Well, I was raised in a hill country in western Oregon and on a little dirt farm, and I grew up in the outdoors. We had to you step out of our house and you're in the outdoors. I grew up in hill country in the forest. We had a couple of live creeks flowing through the place. My older brother taught me how to fish, and he was my role model until he died in World War II. And I just sort of fetched up. I'm like Topsy in in Uncle Tom's cabin.
Well, you grew up in Oregon, but then you moved out to Montana at some point in time. When was that?
We moved here in 1964. My wife and I grew up in, we were kids next door growing up. And we married too young. We had children too soon. And we thrived in it, in spite of it, because we became a team. We moved to Montana in 1964. And we came here because there's more wild country here than there is in most places.
Right. Well, was your first job when you got out to Montana, was that as an outfitter?
No, I moved here. I had a lot of wood products experience where I was raised in Oregon in the timber country. You didn't work unless you worked in the wood products industry. And I came to Montana as a foreman for a new plywood mill in Columbia Falls, northwest Montana in the Flathead Valley. And, of course, that's surrounded by, this country is surrounded by wilderness and lakes and mountains, and it's three wild rivers. It's just the kind of place that I wanted to live. And I worked for the lumber company for 10 years. And just wasn't getting enough outdoor time, so I quit and started outfitting.
Well, for our folks that are in other parts of the world and other parts of the country, back here in the East specifically, and they're not really used to what an outfitter is, tell us a little bit about what an outfitter does and what your career was there.
Well, I guided people into one of the grandest wilderness areas in America, the Bob Marshall Wilderness, and it's roughly a little over a million acres, but there's another million acres of wild country surrounding it, and then Glacier Park. It butts up against Glacier Park on the north end. So it's some of the wildest country in America and some of the most beautiful. And I guided people from all over the world, both hunting and on summer horseback travel trips. Fishing trips. We had one trip that we packed in for 2 days and then floated out fly fishing on one of the best fly fishing rivers in America. We floated out for 5 days, and it was I just led an adventurous and the kind of life that I think most men dream of. I led it.
Well, it's been an exciting life so far, and you were very gracious to send a book to me called My Best Work Is Done at the Office, and some of the stories in here are just so humorous, I guess these are compiled from your outfitting days, aren't they?
Right, they're stories that I got my start as a writer, and even on my radio show, I got my start as a storyteller around a campfire. And some of the stories, people ask me to repeat some of the stories sometimes on trips. So I started paying attention to what stories worked best, and those are the stories that I turned into newspaper columns and radio programs. And eventually, and in fact, the book that you're talking about, My Best Work Is Done at the Office, you might tell people what my office is, by the way, but those are stories that were actually developed around campfires.
Oh gosh, and what a great office to have! I mean, to be able to to have the beautiful country there that you've lived in for your office is just something that people would dream about, especially the folks that are commuting and sitting in these buildings with no window to the outside until they get off. But the book is full of great stories, and as I said, some are just really hilarious. Obviously a great storyteller. One of the things that you're so well known for is being one of the founders of Backcountry Horsemen of America. And talk to us a little bit about who was involved in that with you and how that came about.
Well, it started in a hunting camp in 1972, I'm sorry. And there were three of us, two of my guides and myself, sitting around campfire and talking about one of the problems that we were having. We were faced with a new oncoming regulations that would limit horse use in one of the best horse countries, wilderness in America. And we pondered over what we should do about it, and finally the decision was that we should found or start an organization to combat it. And those people, those two guides, Ken Osk and Dennis Swift, were both long-term friends of mine, both of them horse users, and they were involved right from the beginning. And we brought in another person called Delaine Fulton, who was had just retired as a superintendent of schools in Columbia Falls, and we thought we needed somebody with more intelligence than us. And we involved him in it, and actually the development of backcountry horsemen is a mind-boggling thing. We started just a little club in January 1973. We had our first meeting, and some of our guiding principles, we decided we should not be just an Agenet club, that we should contribute positively to the resource. And we did so through education and through work projects. And we provided a lot of sweat equity and blood equity, you could say, into this while we were fighting tooth and nail against policies that were detrimental to future horse use. And I think we developed a set of principles that, frankly, I'm flabbergasted right now. Both Ken Osk, who's been involved from day one throughout the entire lifetime of backcountry horsemen, which is over 40 years now, and now I understand they have 14,000 members in over half the states in America. And gosh, to be involved in something at the startup and to set in place the kind of principles that that they're embracing yet today and utilizing very, very fruitfully. I'm just overwhelmed that to have been a part of it and still be, you could say.
Well, and I know that you are still involved. Our mutual good friend, Jim McGarvey, who is the current chairman of Backcountry Horsemen, I know seeks guidance and counsel still from you and from Ken, and recently saw a great photograph of the three of you guys, I think, when Jim was out visiting in Montana recently. But what does it feel like to be part of an organization that I'm sure 41 years ago you never dreamed would have grown to what it's done?
We had no idea. We were just a bunch of simple folks, and it is so flattering, you could say, to have been involved in such an organization and still be involved. And I can tell you that Jim McGarvey and the other administrations in backcountry horsemen, both in the state level, the club levels, their administration has been so exemplary. And they're taking backcountry horsemen into an entirely second level. They have the talent and the knowledge and the understanding that a bunch of simple guys out here in Montana, guys and gals, didn't have. We could have never taken it where they're taking it now. And And I certainly embrace it, very much so.
Well, we're thrilled to have been have partnered with Backcountry Horsemen now over a year ago to share information about Backcountry Horsemen and what their goals and their mission and the principles are in establishing and maintaining a relationship with the federal government and working on the local level to help keep these trails open for our horse trail users as well as other people. And it's been amazing to me to just to see the progress that's made in the past year with Backcountry Horsemen. So I suppose when we talk about legacy, this will be part of your legacy and Delane's and Dennis's and Ken's, one that can be looked on in the future and say these guys were visionaries 41 years ago when they started
this.
Pretty
dang smart, weren't we?
Well, it's a good thing you got Delane on board, I guess, wasn't it? goodness. Well, listen, we want to talk about some of your writing, and we're going to take a real quick break and listen to a great song from our friend Don Edwards. And when we come back, Roland, I'd like to talk a little bit about Sapphires at War and an interesting story about how that series of books came to be. So stay with us, and we'll be talking more with Roland Cheek when we come back. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio.
Cowboy I knew in South Texas. His face was burnt deep by the sun. In part history, part sage, and part Mexican, he was there when Pancho Villa was young. And he'd tell you a tale of the old days, when the country was wild all around. He'd sit out under the stars of the Milky Way, and he'd listen while the coyotes they howl. They go, ooh, yippoo, yippoo, ooh, yippoo, yippoo, ooh, yippoo, yippoo, ooh, yippoo, yippoo. Now the longhorns have gone, and the drovers have gone. The Comanche is gone, and the outlaws have gone, and Geronimo's gone, and Sam Bass is gone, and the Red Wolf is gone, and the buffalo's gone. Cursed the automobile, and he said, this ain't no place for an hombre like I am in this new world of asphalt and steel. Then he'd look off someplace in the distance at something only he could see, and he'd say, all that's left now of the old days are them damned old coyotes. Ooh, yippoo, yippoo. Ooh, yippoo, yippoo. Ooh, yippoo, yippoo. Now the longhorns have gone, and the drovers have gone, and the Comanche's gone, and the outlaws have gone, and Geronimo's gone. Stand Watty is gone, and the red wolf is gone, and the buffalo's gone. Then one morning they searched his adobe. He disappeared without even a word. And that night as the moon crossed the mountain, one more coyote was heard. Woo, yippoo, yippoo. Woo,
it's Don Edwards with Coyotes, and we don't want to lose what God has given us to enjoy out in our nature. And so again, we appreciate all the vision and that you guys had when you started Backcountry Horsemen and the work that they continue to do and grow with. But we want to talk a little bit about Sapphires and a series of books that you've written and an interesting story that you shared with me the other day about how that came to be. Would you share that with our audience?
Sure. Can I give you a little bit of background, Gary?
Yes, sir. Please.
First, in 1961, a private plane carrying two men and women flew west from Great Falls, Montana, on a journey to Seattle. The single-engine plane's flight path took it south of Glacier National Park over a stunning cliff formation comprising the backbone of the Rocky Mountains. Unfortunately, the route also took the plane into the teeth of a sudden September blizzard. Although clearing the Chinese Wall with ease, the Mooney's wings began icing. Radioing Great Falls control that he was turning back, to pilot swung the plane around under full power, trying to climb. Instead, the Mooney slammed into the sloping west side of the cliff formation, missing its crest by 18 vertical feet. All three passengers died instantly. Remains of the plane was scattered over a three-acre area near the center of the Bob Marshall Wilderness. That's background. Go further into the story, I entered a barber shop in Columbia Falls, Montana in 1983, and the former sheriff of Flathead County was sitting in a chair undergoing tonsorial polish, and he knew that I was guiding people from all over the world into Bob Marshall. He asked me if I was familiar with the Chinese Wall, and I laughed, and I told him that my hunting camp, early season hunting camp, was within 5 miles of the north end of the Chinese Wall. And he said, are you familiar with do you know anything about a plane that crashed in 1961 on Salt Mountain? And I said, yeah, I've got pictures of the plane, of the remains of the plane. And he told me that he jumped from an airplane in 2 feet of snow, from a helicopter in 2 feet of snow, and to see if there were any survivors. And there were none. But he said, you know what I found in the side pocket of that airplane? And I said, the guy, you had to know the guy. He was sometimes known to jerk a chain of a gullible listener, so I knew that. And I said, what did you find, Dick? And he said, I found a vial containing 26 cut and polished high-quality sapphires. And you said,
oh, wow.
I said, what? And he, of course, he knew that he had set the hook by then. And he told me they were Yogo sapphires. Well, Yogo sapphire mine is in central Montana, almost in the very center of the state. And it turned out, and as I researched the story later on, the Yogo sapphire mine may be the largest, greatest in-site gemstone discovery in world history, even considering the diamonds from South Africa. And but anyway, Dick told me, he said the FBI came in and took the case away from him right away. And he said they thought that the sapphires came from the crown jewels of Hesse that disappeared during the Nazi era in World War II. And, of course, I was really fascinated by then, and I don't know whether the story's true, but he told me that two of the airmen that were in that plane, they were stationed in Frankfurt after World War II, and they both were career Air Force, and they were stationed now in 1961 in Malmstrom Air Base out of Great Falls, and they had a private plane that he thinks that they were on their way to Seattle to fence the stolen jewels.
Oh,
that's
wow.
What he said.
Wow.
Now, I don't know whether the story's true, but it doesn't have to be true. I had my story.
Right.
And I started researching the Yogo Sapphire deposit, and the story is really really beguiling, because the guy that discovered it was a mountain man, a market hunter, and he had already discovered two important gold strikes in Montana. And the way he discovered the mine is he was riding his horse on an open plateau and got caught in a thunderstorm. And he crouched by the side of his horse while the thunderstorm raged, hailstones, rain, buckets, loads of rain. And whenever the storm passed, there were some marmot mounds there, and they were flattened, and he noticed some clear blue stones in the flattened dirt of the marmot mound, and he started picking them up. Well, they surfaced in a crack in the earth that was filled with volcanic material from deep within the bowels of the earth, and he wound up actually filing claims on a 5-mile dike that actually produced more, or capable of producing enough sapphires to flood the world market. And the mine was eventually taken over by an English firm, bought out. Jake Hoover, the discoverer, who was also a friend of Charlie Russell's, the artist in Montana. But the discoverer sold his 25% interest in the mine for $5,000 in 1891 or 2. And later on, the banker who had also had 25% interest sold his 25% for $150,000.
Oh, wow.
A year later. Now, we're talking about big money in those days, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Anyway, I followed the jewels. I started doing the research, and the English company was called Johnson, Walker, and Tolhurst. And they were in a, they had control of, in essence, control of the world sapphire market. And there was a South African company called De Beers that had control of the world diamond market. And they got into a war and to see who could place their gemstones around the most of the beautiful royalty, socially prominent necks and foreheads and earrings, and De Beers did a hell of a marketing job.
Right.
But anyway, that's following that story and knowing that Yogo Sapphires was in the crown jewels of Hesse, I followed that story, and the Hessian royalty was the first principality in Germany to line up in support of Hitler in his rise to power. And as such, Philip, the Crown Prince of Hesse, who married to Princess Mafalda, the daughter of the King of Italy, and Philip was appointed as the ambassador to Rome from Germany. And things went along very well until Italy switched sides during the war, and both Philip and Mafalda was thrown into concentration camps, Philip in Dachau and Mafalda in Berchtesgaden, and Buchenwald. And she didn't survive. She died in a concentration camp. Philip survived. But during the period that the Hessian principality had fallen into disfavor, the Nazis looted the Royal House of Hesse. And that's when the 26 sapphires disappeared. Uh-huh. Now, how the American servicemen acquired the sapphires, you have to read the books.
Well, what is the synopsis of the first book?
The first book is the discovery period.
Okay.
And that's it goes into Jake Hoover's discovery. And the development of the mine also during that period. The fact that, and that's when the English company acquired the mine. The English jewelry firm acquired the mine in order to continue to control the sapphire market, world sapphire market. See, sapphires. Gary, sapphires in European and Oriental royalties was the most prominent jewel until De Beers did such a great job with diamonds. In fact, Prince Charles gave Diana a sapphire engagement ring, and Queen Elizabeth also received a sapphire engagement ring. Sapphires were more a gemstone of love than were diamonds. So the English jewelry firm was afraid they were going to lose control of the sapphire market. So they acquired the mine, the Yogo mine, which incidentally they've taken core samples down over 2,000 feet and found that sapphires are randomly laced throughout all those core samples, clear down to 2,000 feet. So that it's unlimited supply. In fact, the USGS, Geological Survey, wrote a bulletin on it in 1898, I think, that called it the most significant gemstone discovery in America.
And well, I recently read in Wikipedia, which is a pretty good resource to go back to, but I recently read in Wikipedia that the estimate is that there are still at least 28 million carats of Yogos still in the ground.
Oh, I'm sure that, and I don't know how they'd come up with that, but it's obvious there's millions and millions of dollars worth of. But they can't, you know, they're afraid if there's a possibility they could flood the world market and diminish the value of the sapphire. So,
right. Well, as we go into sapphire wars, and I think that the story follows. Jake, and what was the young lady's name, Ringgold?
Millie Ringgold.
Millie Ringgold.
And these are real people. These are real people. Millie Ringgold was a half-black lady who had two gold claims on Yogo Creek. And she was supposedly, she said that she had been in service to the people in the White House, in presidents in America. Now, she made that claim, and she apparently had a lot of service, in-service background, because she demonstrated that in Yogo Gulch, but she was a very independent-minded woman. And there was some question about whether she had begun as a slave.
Mm-hmm.
But she was beautiful, and she had an assignation with Jake Hoover, and they had a child, and the child's name was Naseby Ringgold, and the book goes on. Jake eventually wound up in the Yukon, and he died there, and Millie Ringgold died. She was one of the last survivors in the gold discovery on Yogo Creek, which she died there, and her son was orphaned at 10 years old, and he was adopted, in essence, by the mine superintendent for the Yogo mine, which was the original discovery for Jake Hoover. And the story goes on that he later wound up in England and worked for the English company. And I can't, that should be enough to pique their interest. The book is an e-book. Come out as an ebook. You can get it on Amazon for $5.99. And the other book, the first book, is named Yogo, and it's also on Amazon for $4.99, I think, as an ebook.
All right. Well, we would encourage people to pick the book up. It's going to be an interesting story, the first book, and then leading into, and I don't suppose there was any thought of revenge or retribution on the son's part in that second book. But
yes, there was.
But we'll tempt the audience to try to find out a little bit more about that, and then I believe you said there probably will be a third book to come.
The third book will be called Sapphires and Swastikas. It'll take place in Germany during the rise of Adolf Hitler.
Well, you're a tremendous writer, and I'm sure the books will be something that people will want to pick up and read and follow the story from the discovery to where the third book takes us into Germany, and we continue that question and mystery that surrounds those sapphires that ended up back in Montana. Roland, you're just an interesting fellow. We could talk on about the columns. We could talk about 7 years that you did the radio program. And I don't know whether your legacy will be left in the books that you write, but it certainly will be in helping to establish Backcountry Horsemen of America. And for all of the trail riders across the country, we appreciate the fact that you helped start an organization that works diligently to make sure that these trails are still open for our use and will continue to be, to continue the legacy and the heritage that we have for trail use with our horses. So thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It was my pleasure.
I do want to mention this. They can find you on Facebook. You also, we hadn't talked about your blogs, but we're going to have you back and talk about that. But you have several different blogs, and so we want to encourage people to follow those as well. And is there a Facebook page for any of your blogs?
No, only through my website.
All right, and what is that?
Well, it's very, very difficult for people to remember. It's RolandCheek.com.
All right. So visit RolandCheek.com. I've been to the website. It's fascinating. A lot of interesting reading there on the website. And go visit his Facebook page as well. And Roland Cheek, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you for being you, Gary.
Well, thank you. We're going to close out this segment with another of Roland's Trails to Outdoor Adventure, and this is The Perfect Horse. And, Roland, look forward to talking with you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Howdy, I'm Roland Cheek. Someone pointed and we all laughed as the horse thrust his head through the cook tent door. Though the rest of the outfitter's horses grazed out of sight and sound, apparently this particular pony found human companionship to his liking. The horse in question was the most docile of any free-roaming ponies I've observed amid the wilderness, and I've seen a bunch. I talked about the horse who wouldn't leave camp with Bill Tidwell, the outfitter, asking if the pony was a good wrangle horse. He sputtered, "He's not worth a darn, roughest riding horse that ever lived." Then Bill pointed to the corral where another of his horses whinnied for his equine friends. "General, now, there's my wrangle horse. He can sniff out the loose horses just like a bloodhound." Others of Bill's horses were best at packing, safest to carry guests, easiest to mount, had best backs, any one of dozens of features, but no single horse had them all. I thought about once asking the question of John Bullock, my old horse mentor. John was an old-time horseman off Oklahoma's Cherokee Reserve. He had been a top hand at saddle bronc riding on the big rodeo circuit, back almost before combustion engines. He had cowboyed on ranches all over the West, in Utah, Nevada, Dakotas, and Idaho, Washington, and Wyoming, Arizona, and Oregon, and Montana, and Texas. John was from the old horseman school of run wild stock in from the range, rope 'em, snub 'em fast, ear 'em down, saddle 'em, blindfold 'em, swing into a stirrup and ride 'em till they quit. Early on, I learned all I knew about horses from the toothless old cowboy. So it was natural one cold winter day to ask John if he had ever seen a horse that was perfect in every way. His answer next. John Bullock had ridden thousands of horses of every shape, breed, and color. He had personally owned dozens, perhaps hundreds, and when I asked if he had ever known a horse who was perfect in every way, the old man turned to stare out the window while he plumbed the depths of his memory. Quarter horses, Appaloosas, thoroughbreds, walkers, pacers, trotters, big horses, little horses, range horses, plow horses, rodeo broncs, ropers, bulldoggers, palomino, buckskin, paint, bay, sorrel, and white, all passed before staring eyes. John was quiet so long I wondered if he had forgotten the question. Then he turned to me and broke into a toothless grin. It sure would have been a good one, wouldn't it? Monday I'll be back with a tale about losing a foot race with migrating elk. Until Monday, this is Roland Cheek saying so long on Trails to Outdoor Adventure.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed the show today, visiting with the lovely and talented Mary Kay and Roland Cheek, extremely interested and talented writer, and just a great gentleman to visit with. And if you enjoyed the Trails to Outdoor Adventure, send us a message at equestrianlegacy.net and let us know. Maybe we could talk Roland into sharing a few more of those with us to broadcast on the Campfire Cafe. But enjoyed the show today, and I hope you did as well. I want to remind you that the second half of our show was brought to you by Equestrian Legacy Radio's Legacy Club sponsors. The Legacy Club membership is free, and members receive special offers and discounts available only to Legacy Club members. And you're automatically entered in our weekly, monthly, and year-end drawings for great gifts from our Legacy Club sponsors. So to enroll in that, visit equestrianlegacy.net. And again, that's a free club membership with great benefits as well. This Sunday on Blessed Trails with Belinda Gale, Belinda welcomes Gary Brown, the founder of the Monterey Cowboy Poetry and Music Festival. And Blessed Trails with Belinda Gale airs at 9 o'clock Central Standard Time on Equestrian Legacy Radio. And then on Tuesday, Jim McGarvey, the chairman of Backcountry Horsemen of America, joins us on Saddle Up America, and will also visit Hobo's Hideout in Colorado. So we'll be traveling to Colorado to visit Hobo's Hideout. And then next week on the Campfire Cafe, we're going to visit with some Canadian friends and folks with a Canadian influence when we welcome to the show Trinity Seeley and other friends from just north of the border. We remind you, as always, if you climb in the saddle, get ready for the ride on Equestrian Legacy Radio, hurled worldwide online at equestrianlegacy.net. Thanks for listening.
Headed out for the barn. He set down his coffee, strapped on his sidearm, with a glance to his wife. Not a word or a sound. She knew today he'd lay his old pony down. Indian summer had come to an end, and the wicked winter was coming again. And he knew as he glanced at his old faithful friend, sometimes the best gift is goodbye. And he knows better than asking questions like, why, Lord, why? He is just doing his level best. Oh, he tries, tries, tries. We live at all. Ashes to ashes and dust to dust, we are all living the lives that we must, somewhere between the dawn and the dusk. Dying down tarp, whipped in the wind, saving its grimmest task to the end. Then he takes the halter down from the wall, leads that old pony out from the stall. They talk of years back and the rodeo days, all the hunts and the kids this horse helped to raise. And as the sun threw its last heavenly rays, it was a sweet and tearful good. He knows better than asking questions like, why, Lord, why? He is just doing his level best. Oh, he tries, tries, tries. We live it all, we rise and we fall, over and over again. Ashes to ashes and dust. We are all living the lives that we must, somewhere between the dawn and the dusk. Turns up his collar, walks home to his wife. He considers God's plan and he ponders his life. And he knows it's no shame in dying at all. Your only shame is living too small. And he is no king of commerce or trade. And all that he owns his strong hands made. And a figure's just treasure it all till the good Lord comes to lead him from the start. And he will know better than asking questions like, why, Lord, why? He'll know he's done his level best, that he tried, tried.